You're tuned to the national network of Springbok Radio. We are operating on FM, medium wave, and shortwave transmitters in the 90 and 120 meter bands. And remember that our late night program this evening, Sari 68, features the Afrikaans orchestras. That'll take the air at about 10:36. And, well, if you're a fan of the Buru Orchestra, you can hear that at 10:36 tonight. I can see our operator outside, who's controlling me at the moment with all sorts of little needles and meters and so on and so forth. He is, and he'll be tuned in. He has to be. He can't get away. He's working. Anyway, that's at 10:36 tonight. Springbok Radio time right now is 8:30.
The court is now in session, silence in court. Ernest Archibald Pearson, you're charged that on the 7th day of April this year, that is 1967, you did at a place known as Blagden in the county of Somerset, unlawfully and with malice aforethought, take the life of one Brian Richfield. How say you to this charge? You plead guilty or not guilty?
This whole thing is a nightmare. Of course I didn't do it.
Record a plea of not guilty.
It's time for you to take your place on the jury as Bristol Myers, makers of New Ban Roll-On and New Ban Aerosol Spray Deodorant, Clairol Hair Care Products, and Ipana Toothpaste, invite you to... consider your verdict.
It will not be necessary for the Crown to detail the case against the prisoner at the bar, Ernest Pearson. Why do I say this? Simply because the basic facts are irrefutable and require no elaboration. It is common cause that on the morning of April the 7th, Richfield was found hanging from a fixture attached to the ceiling of the bedroom he was occupying. It is equally established that the bedroom in question was part of the residence belonging to the prisoner at the bar. Now, the door of his room had been locked from the inside, and there was no apparent way of gaining other access to the bedroom. Thus, it would seem that the death of this unfortunate young man was brought about by his own hand. However, due to the vigilance of the police officer in charge of the investigation of what appeared to be suicide, certain facts were brought to light which will be placed before the court. You will hear that not only did Pearson have a strong motive for wishing Richfield's death, but also that he had actually threatened the now dead man but a few weeks previously. That, coupled with evidence, will lead you to the inescapable conclusion that the death of Brian Richfield was not the result of suicide, but of cold-blooded, deliberate murder. I now call my first witness, Mrs. Mary Sanders. Mrs. Sanders, you are employed as cook housekeeper by Mr. Pearson.
Yes, sir. I was with the family for over 12 years.
Mr. Pearson is a widower, is he not?
That's right, sir. Mrs. Pearson passed away about 6 years ago. Mind you, she was always in delicate health, poor dear.
On April the 16th, his daughter Margaret celebrated her 18th birthday.
Yes, sir, she did.
She was your employer's only child.
Yes, sir. As sweet a girl as you could wish.
And Mr. Pearson was very fond of his daughter.
Fond of her? He worshipped the ground she walked on. Miss Margaret was all he had to live for, he used to say.
Did you know the deceased, Brian Richfield?
Yes, sir. He was courting Miss Margaret.
Did you get the impression that Mr. Pearson approved of this?
Well, I know he didn't, sir. He didn't approve at all.
Did he, in your hearing, give the reasons for this disapproval?
Well, he didn't think young Master Brown was good enough for his daughter.
Did Richfield frequently visit the house?
Oh, no, sir. The master would never have stood for that.
How did you know?
Well, Miss Margaret used to confide in me, like she told me she was in love with him, and how she often used to go out and meet him away from the house.
Yes, there was one occasion in February when Richfield visited the Pearsons' home, did he not?
Yes, sir, he did. I remember it well. I answered a knock at the door, and there he was, standing there.
Did you show him in?
Oh, yes, sir. He said he had an appointment. I showed him into the library where Mr. Pearson was reading.
Did you overhear what passed between your employer and Mr. Richfield?
Well, yes, sir. You see, I was working in the dining room next to the library. I didn't hear anything at first except a mumble of voices, but then I heard Mr. Pearson shouting. He was saying, "No son of Arthur Richfield will marry my daughter."
Look, this ridiculous feud between you and my father...
Feud, you call it? Your father went to jail for 7 years because, as my solicitor, he defrauded me of £60,000. Ridiculous, you call it.
All right, my father committed a crime, and he's paying for it. But that's nothing to do with me.
Hasn't it? Why were you expelled from school?
Well, I was younger. It was all a mistake.
Mistake, indeed. Richfield, there's a streak in your family that is rotten through and through.
Now, look here.
Young man, I don't propose to argue with you. I have allowed you to see me, to tell you that I will never consent to your marrying my daughter.
Then Margaret and I will marry without your consent. I'm sorry,
but... Forget that she is underage.
She is now, but it won't be long before she's of age.
And how do you propose to support her?
When Margaret becomes 21, she'll inherit the money your wife left her. She's agreed that I should go to university so that I can have a proper profession.
Really? You plan to marry and live off my daughter?
That isn't true.
Oh, isn't it?
No, it's not. We love each other.
I doubt if a Richfield could love anybody.
Say what you like. Margaret and I are going to get married with or without your consent.
If you think I'm going to allow my daughter to marry a wastrel and a scoundrel, you're very much mistaken. Oh, I know my daughter thinks she's in love with you. But no good can come of it. I'll do all I can to stop it.
But you can't, can you? Oh, you can prevent her seeing me for a while. But after
I warned you. I would kill you before I'd let you harm my daughter. Do you hear me? I would kill you.
You heard that, did you? You swear on oath that you distinctly heard Mr. Pearson threaten the life of Mr. Richfield?
Yes, sir, I did.
I now want you to tell us something about the morning of the 8th, the day when Richfield's body was found hanging from a fixture attached to the ceiling of the bedroom.
Well, I'll tell you all I know.
First of all, you were present when the body was discovered.
Yes. Yes, I was.
Would you describe what you saw?
Well, sir, I took Mr. Richfield his morning tea and I couldn't get an answer. I knocked and I knocked. Mr. Richfield! Mr. Richfield! Mr. Richfield!
Well, Mrs. Arnold, why are you creating such a commotion?
It's Mr. Richfield, sir. I can't get any reply.
Probably fast asleep. Why did you just walk in?
Well, I tried to, sir, but the door's locked.
Certainly appears to be a sound sleeper. Here, let me try. Richfield, wake up! Richfield, wake up! Locking his door like a frightened young female.
I don't think anyone could sleep through this racket.
Well, come with me. We'll go around the back and look through the windows. I suppose he is in the room.
We went round onto the lawn, looked through the window. Oh, it was horrible. There he was, dangling from the ceiling. I couldn't believe my eyes.
Most unpleasant for you. Then what happened?
Well, Mr. Pearson broke the pane of glass and bolted the window from the inside, rushed in. He shouted to me to get the kitchen knife. He cut the rope. He asked me to help him put Mr. Richfield on the bed. He was all limp and folded up like his face all blue. Oh, it's terrible.
Very nasty experience for you, Mrs. Arnett. Then what happened?
Well, Mr. Pearson says, I seem to have driven this young man to suicide. I must call the police.
He did, sir?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. That is all. Mrs. Saunders, do you view my client in a friendly light?
I don't know what you mean, sir.
Do you like your employer?
Well, I don't think one way or the other.
Come, Mrs. Saunders, you worked with him for 12 years. Surely you must have some definite opinion as to his character or his work.
Well, I don't like the way he tried to separate those two, that's a fact.
Mrs. Saunders, my client strongly denies ever uttering the words. I quote your evidence. Richfield, I warn you, I would kill you before I would let you harm my daughter.
He said them. It's true.
Mrs. Saunders, you say that you heard these threats being uttered when you were in the dining room and my client and Richfield were in the library.
That's right, sir.
There is a communicating door between the library and the dining room?
Yes, sir.
Was the door open or closed?
It was closed.
I see. And the other door? The door giving access to the library from the hall. Was that open?
I don't know, sir.
Now, come, come. According to your evidence, you showed your visitor into the library where your employer was reading. Did you not close the door when you left them?
I can't remember, sir.
But would you not do so as a normal procedure?
I suppose so, yes.
Mrs. Saunders, I conducted an experiment at the house. I asked one of my juniors to go into the library and shout at the top of his voice, whilst I and a colleague listened in the dining room. It was impossible to distinguish what was being shouted in the library.
Well, I don't know about that, but I heard it, I tell you.
You did you? On discovering the body, Mr. Pearson suggested that you accompany him to the back of the house.
Yes, sir.
It was he who cut the young man down and suggested calling the police.
Yes, sir.
Would you say that your employer was shocked?
Yes, I would, sir.
You've known him for 12 years. You've made it pretty evident that you do not regard your employer in a favorable light. Mrs. Saunders, have you ever regarded Mr. Pearson as a murderer?
My lord, never in all my life.
My dear Brockenhurst, you are far too experienced a man.
Very well, my lord, I apologize. I did not mean to get this witness to act as a judge and jury. Ever since she entered the witness box, her manner and speech has expressed a dislike for her employer and a determination to paint him in the worst possible light.
That's not true.
Mr. Brockenhurst, if you persist in attempting to turn this courtroom into the kind of legal inquiry so favored by the yellow press and American films, I shall stop the trial and see to it that you are duly admonished. I do not want to have to warn you again. This witness has a right to be protected, and she will be. Now, sir, the least you can do is to apologize to the court and to this witness in particular.
It would seem, my lord, that whatever I say now can only prove prejudicial to my client. I apologize to the court and to this witness. My lord, you are not preventing me from commenting, I trust?
The question is unworthy of you.
I apologize for the question. I merely wish to make the comment that this witness's story of overhearing such a damaging conversation, damaging to my client, that is, has no corroboration whatsoever.
Is my learned friend accusing Mrs. Saunders of perjury?
No, I am not. I am, however, diagnosing a psychological state in which, like the celebrated young Frenchwoman and her voices, which did not exist, Mrs. Saunders may not be a Joan of Arc, but has a vivid sense of the dramatic. That is all.
I think, Mr. Brockenhurst, we will call for an adjournment. And you will please see me in my chambers.
And so the usher announces the trial of Ernest Pearson for the murder of Brian Richfield, temporarily suspended, and the court adjourns. This dramatized version of the trial is brought to you by Bristol Myers. Now back to the courtroom. The judge presiding waits until the usher has announced the resumption of the trial. The leading characters have resumed their seats, and the judge says,
"Gentlemen of the jury, it is to be regretted that in an excess of concern for his client, leading counsel for the defense has made statements which may imply, certainly will cause you to infer, that much of Mrs. Saunders' evidence is suspect. It is my duty to direct you that you must weigh everything that she has said and to place on it what degree of importance you wish. Should you accept or reject any part of her evidence, you are in no way causing such acceptance or rejection to reflect upon the good character of this witness. Sir Richard,
As your lordship pleases. I would like to call to the witness stand Detective Inspector Philip Masters. Inspector, I understand that you were summoned to the home of the Pearsons on the morning of the 8th of April.
Yes, I was telephoned by Mr. Pearson.
Can you give the substance of his telephonic statement to you?
I can. The prisoner said that a young man had committed suicide in his house, and would I go there urgently?
Is such a procedure not unusual? Would not such a message to the police be received by the duty officer?
It was. What I really meant to say is that Pearson put a phone call through to the police and asked whether I was available, as he had an urgent message to give.
I see. Carry on, please.
I expressed astonishment that he should report the tragic incident to me personally. Pearson said that he was doing so because he wished to avoid any scandal, that he was extremely worried about his daughter, due to return that day, and that he would be grateful if I called personally, as he was a well-known and respected head of one of our best county families. I went over, accompanied by Sergeant Smith.
Thank you, Inspector. It was good of you to come personally. I do appreciate it.
That's all right. You say you've got a suicide in the house.
Doesn't bear thinking about.
Where did it happen?
In this room over here.
Young Richfield?
I cut the rope and I put him on the bed.
Well, I didn't know that he was a friend.
He's hardly a friend, Inspector. He wanted to marry my daughter. Now, this is going to be a great shock for the poor child.
What made him commit suicide?
I don't know. I suggested he stay here while Margaret was away. I wanted to have it out with him once and for all. I wanted to show him our standard of living compared with what he would provide, even with her mother's inheritance. Well, the prospect depressed him so much that he took his life. There's no other explanation.
But why here, under your roof?
Well, I'll tell you why. I find it difficult to speak ill of a man whose corpse is lying in front of me. He was neurotic to a degree. It is my view that he committed suicide in my house rather than in his own, in order that my daughter might hate me for the rest of my life, and our neighbors point an accusing finger. There can be no other explanation.
Daddy!
Take much notice of Miss Pearson's outburst. She had been informed by Mrs. Saunders, and the shock of seeing a young man lying there could have caused her to say anything.
Nevertheless, it remained in your memory.
Naturally.
Of course. Now would you describe the scene as you first saw it when you entered the room?
The dead body of Richfield was on the bed. Around his neck was the rope. It had obviously been cut from a rope that was suspended from the ceiling. In the center of the floor, by the dangling rope, was an upturned chair. The French windows leading to the lawn were open. One pane had been shattered.
Your first impression was that the young man had stood on the chair while attaching the rope to the chandelier fittings screwed to the ceiling. Then he tied the other end of the rope around his neck and committed suicide by kicking the chair from beneath him.
That was my first impression, yes.
What made you change your mind?
Well, I suppose I began to feel uneasy because of the bedroom being locked. You see, when I arrived at the house, I was shown into the room. And later, I inquired from the servant who had unlocked the door. She said that Mr. Pearson had picked up the key off the dressing table and proceeded to unlock the door when he left the room to telephone the police.
Carry on.
Well, sir, I asked Mr. Pearson if Mrs. Saunders was correct. And he said yes. He said that the key was not in a lock and that he found it on the dressing table.
Did you find this strange?
Under normal circumstances, sir, no. But for a would-be suicide to carefully lock the door on the inside and place it on the dressing table struck me as being rather peculiar.
Did this fact cause you to suspect, Mr. Pearson?
Not that single fact, no. There were other contributory factors.
Such as?
Well, the bed had obviously been slept in. When I arrived, the young man was still in his pajamas. It didn't add up. In my experience, it is unusual for a person who has reached such a stage of mental unbalance as to want to commit suicide. It is unusual for them to retire to their bed after carefully undressing and putting on their night attire. And when one adds to the fact that the precise way in which the door was locked and the key removed, well, sir, I began to suspect that the young man had not taken his own life and decided to investigate the matter further.
An investigation that was to lead to the arrest of the prisoner.
Yes, sir. You see, it didn't add up. There was no doubt that Miss Pearson was determined to marry the young man when she came of age. She was to receive an annuity of £1,500 a year after tax for the rest of her life. Diaries left by the young man revealed that far from being depressed, he was scornful of the father's inability to stop the marriage.
You sought medical advice?
I did. The county surgeon's sworn affidavit declares that it is his considered opinion that Richfield was rendered unconscious and then so suspended from a rope as to cause his death.
Did you receive explanations justifying this principle?
Yes, sir. 2 grams of xylitol were found in the deceased's body, indicating that he must have been unconscious within a few seconds of swallowing this drug.
Xylitol is a barbiturate.
Yes, sir. It's most potent, and given only in extreme cases and in very small doses.
Carry on, please.
Examination of the neck of the dead body showed 2 distinct horizontal marks. One indicating very clearly that Richfield was strangled by means of the rope. The other indicating that the mark was made by the weight of the body causing pressure on the rope.
Thank you, Inspector. That is all.
Inspector, you've known my client for a number of years. Would you describe him as a highly intelligent man?
Yes, I would.
Would you have regarded it as an intelligent act to ask for the most senior CID policeman in the county to call if he were guilty?
I do not see the relevance.
Suppose he made just a routine telephone call. The visit would have been made by a sergeant or someone of lesser rank.
Yes, sir, it would.
Is it not a fair assumption that the dangling cord, the upturned chair, the locked room... I repeat, is it fair assumption that the average policeman would have satisfied himself that it was a case of suicide?
Possibly.
Was not calling the most experienced detective in the county indicative of my client's innocence?
No, sir. I think that the accused hoped to convince me of the young man's suicide and wished to use my authority to keep the matter secret from the public.
Why should he want to do that? In view of his known antipathy to the young man.
For his daughter's sake.
Medical testimony, Inspector, says that prior to the man's death by hanging, he had swallowed 2 grams of xylitol. Were you able to trace where this came from?
No, sir.
During the course of your investigation, were you able to reveal one instance where my client had purchased such a drug?
No.
You made every attempt? You questioned pharmacists, doctors, and so on?
Yes, of course I did.
And the house? You made a thorough search of the house?
Yes.
You found no trace of xylitol? Or for that matter, a container that might have held the drug?
No, I didn't.
Did you question the rest of the household, the daughter, Mrs. Sanders, whether they knew anything of a xylitol capsule or container?
I did.
Without any success?
That is so.
Inspector, do you find it peculiar that a man should want to lock his door and remove the key and place it on the dressing table?
Yes, sir.
Why? Do you not regard it as normal that a man sleeping in a strange house should want to lock the door?
It is the removal of the key and the placing of it on the dressing table that I find strange.
Really, Inspector? Would it surprise you to learn that when I am on circuit, I invariably lock the door of the hotel room and remove the key? Does this surprise you?
A little.
But not sufficiently to want to hang a man for it.
That is just it, sir. It is the hanging I'm concerned with. I don't think a suicide would remove the key and carefully put it on a dressing table.
Are you certain he wouldn't?
Of course I'm not certain.
A handsome admission. Now, this xylitol found in the deceased's body. Did you attempt to find out whether the young man was taking such a drug?
There was no point. He was unconscious when he was hanged by the neck from the ceiling.
You are not a medical man.
You know I'm not, sir.
As a senior detective, you have been involved in many trials where expert medical opinion has been stated.
Yes.
Have you not known cases where leading medical authorities have violently disagreed with each other?
I have.
Were you not failing in your duty to determine whether the young man had ever had xylitol in his possession?
Even if he had, the dose taken was a lethal one. He would not be in a position to hang himself.
Have you not thought that a young man so depressed at the thought of losing Miss Pearson might make doubly sure in his suicide attempt? First, he swallowed the xylitol, and then prepared a rope for himself to hang himself.
You forget, sir, that a man would go into a coma within 3 or 4 seconds of swallowing the drug.
You were told it?
By experts.
And you are prepared to believe it?
Yes.
Do you not know that for every drug used, somewhere there is a human being who has an allergy or resistance to that drug?
No, I didn't. I am not a medical man.
Thank you for confessing your ignorance.
I now call Dr. Robert Morgan. Dr. Morgan, you are quite convinced that there were 2 distinct marks on the deceased's neck, clearly indicating that he was choked whilst lying in a horizontal position? While the latter mark was caused while he was hanging from the rope suspended from the ceiling?
Aye.
Would you care to elaborate on that?
Well, certainly. In the first instance, the marks were those suggesting that the rope was cutting into the neck deeply. There were no skin tears or abrasions. In the second instance, the marks revealed distinct traces of abrasions caused by the tearing of the skin as the weight of the body dragged against the rope.
Thank you, Doctor. Your sworn affidavit tells of the finding of over 2 grams of xylitol in the deceased body. Would it be possible for a human being to swallow xylitol and remain conscious for any length of time?
No, sir. No human being can remain conscious for longer than 7 or 8 seconds at the very most. The average person would lose consciousness within a couple of seconds.
Are there any exceptions to this rule?
No, sir. Xylitol is of the barbituric group.
Thank you, Dr. Morgan. That is all. And that closes the case for the Crown, my love.
No questions.
Well, you have heard all the relevant facts. Would you say that Ernest Archibald Pearson is guilty or not guilty of murder? In a few moments, we shall bring you the verdict recorded in the actual trial upon which this dramatic presentation is based.
Coronation Court! Gentlemen of the jury! Have you arrived at a true and just verdict?
We have, my lord. We find the prisoner at the bar guilty of murder.
Bristol Myers, makers of New Ban Roll-On and New Ban Aerosol Spray Deodorant, Ipana Toothpaste, and Clairol Hair Care Products, hope you enjoyed tonight's presentation of Consider Your Verdict, produced by Michael Silver. On Friday evening at 8:30, you're invited to listen to Medical File, another great dramatic series also brought to you by Bristol Myers. So, goodbye until next Tuesday, when it will be time once again to take your place on the jury of Consider Your Verdict.